Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Lawrence Sheikman appearing for Consolidated Rail Corporation. This is a case on appeal from the District Court granting motion for judgment on the pleadings. The District Court in this case was sitting as the special court under the Regional Rail Reorganization Act. The District Court granted the plaintiff's motion for judgment, holding that the question of Conrail's liability for pre-April 1st, 1976 claims under the Federal Employers Liability Act is a question of state law to be litigated on a case-by-case basis, either in the state or federal courts in which the underlying FELA cases are pending. Conrail's position on appeal is that the court should have either granted Conrail's motion for summary judgment on the basis of the conveyance order and the conveyance documents, or simply denied both motions. The court's familiar with its jurisdiction, having recently decided Conrail against the City of Jersey City, in which Judge Henderson was the author of the opinion, which arises under 719 E1 and E2 of the Rail Act. The appellee makes some mention of the fact that we had made a claim under the Declaratory Judgment Act. The basis of jurisdiction here, we contend, is 719 E1 and E2. The standard of review is de novo. Judge Urbina, sitting as the special court in this case, had no special expertise. The orders that he was interpreting were not his own. The decisions were not his own. He was simply sitting as the currently designated judge of the special court. There is an elephant in the room here, which is the claim that somehow this plaintiff will be left remedy-less unless Conrail's motion is denied and the decision of the special court is affirmed. In that connection, let me direct your attention to Exhibit 1 to our complaint in the District Court, which is a copy of the complaint pending in the Cuyahoga Court of Common Pleas in Ohio, which by my count lists 83 defendants in addition to Conrail, suggesting that, as is often the case in asbestos litigation, there are a plethora of manufacturers and others to whom the plaintiff, the underlying plaintiff, or as a state in this case, might look for relief.
So Conrail could also cross-claim.
I'm sorry?
Conrail could also cross-claim against all those manufacturers and installers, couldn't it?
Conrail could cross-claim, but the question is, before this court...
No, I understand, but okay. Just to be clear.
Yes, we could do that. That's correct, Your Honor. The conveyance to Conrail was not an ordinary conveyance. It was one which was designed by a government agency, directed by a special three-judge United States District Court. It was an asset-based conveyance of rail properties under the Rail Act, Section 70214. Rail properties means assets or rights owned, leased, or otherwise controlled by the railroad and then in reorganization. There's no mention in the statutory language of a conveyance of any liabilities. There was, in the context of the special court's original conveyance orders, some very limited instances in which specific liabilities that had been those of the railroads in reorganization conveying assets to Conrail were in fact conveyed to Conrail. This was not such a circumstance.
I'm sorry, say that what was in fact conveyed?
I'm sorry. The only assets were conveyed in those cases in which there was an intention to convey liabilities. Either the statute provided for that. For example, in 743B4 of the Rail Act, there's a provision that required Conrail to assume all of the equipment leases, presumably because the equipment lessors had some special sway when the statute was being written.
B4, 745 U.S.C. section 743B, either 3 or 4,
Your Honor. I'm not sure which.
It's not mentioned in your table of authorities. B2 is the only one mentioned.
Okay, B2 is the provision designating the conveyance generally.
I don't remember your pointing this out about another provision expressly conveying the liability.
I don't think it's necessarily material to the argument here, Your Honor.
Seems to be the first thing you've mentioned. I'm surprised it's not material.
By the same token, the claims against Conrail remain behind. We now know, given the Third Circuit...
Why shouldn't we draw the contrary inference? That that would not make sense. Go ahead.
Let me say this. In every special court case, in every one that we can find, and I think we found them all, addressing the question of whether Conrail is the successor to the bankrupt railroads, there is no case that is ruled in, there's no case that's ruled against Conrail in that circumstance. And there's no case that's held that Conrail is the successor in interest to any one of these bankrupt railroads. And if you were to look at plaintiff's state court complaint, again, in paragraph 2 of Exhibit 1, there's a claim made there that Conrail is the successor in interest to the Erie Lackawanna Railroad. Let me talk a little bit about the special court's jurisprudence.
But I just want to be clear here. If an employee of Erie Lackawanna had broken his leg 3 or 4 times and the leg had healed, and now, after 1976, was an employee of Conrail and breaks his leg again, you're not suggesting, or are you, that you don't take your employees as you find them?
We are not suggesting that.
All right. So what is different about this claim?
This is a claim. There are two kinds of claims here. The question before the court now is whether in those circumstances in which an employee was exposed to asbestos prior to April 1st of 1976, and let's assume, and not thereafter. That is, the employee never worked for Conrail. But the injury then, as is the case apparently, manifests itself 30 years later or 40 years later. Does Conrail somehow become responsible even though Conrail never exposed that person to asbestos?
Well, my hypothetical is Conrail had nothing to do with this employee breaking his leg. You know, the Erie Lackawanna, let's say, was negligent, and that's why he broke his leg.
I thought in your hypothetical you posited that Conrail had somehow caused the employee to break his leg while he was in Conrail's employ.
Oh, he broke it again, and so he's suing. Right.
Right. No, we're not suggesting that, you know, as a medical matter, if the break somehow was exacerbated by the prior incidents, I think Conrail does take its employees as it finds them. But the question here is whether Conrail, which did nothing, ought to somehow become the common law successor to the Erie Lackawanna, or whether instead the Rail Act supplies the rule of decision. The plaintiff in the state court, the defendant below, relies heavily on the special court's decision in the Redding case. As I think we pointed out in our briefs, the Redding case was a limited decision involving the court's jurisdiction under the Northeast Rail Services Act.
I thought your point was the court's jurisdiction was limited.
That's correct.
And the court's, therefore, the analysis should be discarded. And the district court said, no, that doesn't take away the force of the analysis.
But the force of the analysis was limited by the court's jurisdiction in that circumstance. Mm-hmm. The other special court case on which the defendant relies here is the Penn Central case, which involved a question of whether Conrail was liable for pre-conveyance CERCLA liability. And I think that while there is some language in that opinion, I would concede, that discusses generally the free and clear language, I think what's important is the court's holding in that case, which is we hold that the conveyance documents, read in light of the Rail Act's Fresh Start policy, limit the liability of the railroad defendants to the time of the conveyances forward. So when Judge Wisdom wrote the opinion, he said, Conrail's responsible for the period April 1, 76 forward. The Penn Central remains responsible for the period before that. How he got there by his reasoning, I think, is not that significant. What is significant is the result that he ultimately achieved. Interestingly, Judge Wiener, who later sat as the special court, in the Department of General Services case involving the Pittsburgh Convention Center underscored the meaning of the Penn Central CERCLA decision. He explained there that CERCLA was really an exception to the Fresh Start policy, and there held that common law doctrines don't apply, and that there was no, he observed in that case, there was no counterbalancing environmental policy to outweigh the fact that successor liability doctrines, common law successor liability doctrines, did not apply under the Rail Act.
Mr. Sheik, refresh me or explain, please, about the nature, the makeup of the special court. This is the railroad court that was created in 76. But at that time, did it not have a three-judge district court?
Yes. At the time of its original creation, it was formed by the multi-district panel. It consisted of judges Friendly, Wisdom, and Thompson. It sat as a three-judge court. There was no right of appeal except to the Supreme Court, and that only happened once in the special court's history involving the original decision on whether the Rail Act was constitutional. Thereafter, in 1981, when the Northeast Rail Services Act was passed, the volume of litigation under that statute multiplied. There was a second panel, the so-called 1152 panel, which was the jurisdiction of the court under the Northeast Rail Services Act. And that consisted of three other judges. Judge Bryant was among them, as was Judge Wiener, and Judge Green at the time from the District of Columbia. So they sat as the 1152 panel. So there were really two courts exercising different jurisdiction. The Reading Court was the 1152 court. So I think that responds, Judge Ginsburg, to your question.
The Reading Court was also three judges?
Also
three judges.
Yes, both courts were three judges.
And today, same thing?
Well, no. Today, the special court was theoretically abolished. Its jurisdiction was transferred to a single judge in the District of Columbia, and we don't know how, but Judge Urbina was assigned to sit as the special court. Judge Wiener had been the single special court judge before his passing.
So the standard of review for motion for summary judgment aside, is there any reason to treat the decisions of the district judge here any differently than we do those of our district court generally?
There is not.
Okay. There's no claim to specialization here anymore.
There is not, Your Honor.
Okay. You seem to be making a lot of what the rail court had said, but you don't have anything from a court of appeals?
Well, that's because there's never been a court of appeals decision. Before this court's decision in the City of Jersey City case, there had never been a court of appeals decision involving the Rail Act.
What was the Third Circuit case that was, I think you said, was essentially overruled?
Schweitzer and Zolkowski were two Third Circuit decisions involving the question of whether the reorganized railroads remain liable for their own asbestos claims. And in that circumstance, the Third Circuit had held that they did not, that they did remain liable, that the claims were not subject to discharge. And while the Third Circuit never mentioned FALA in the Geldwin case, which it recently decided, our position is that those cases, that is Zolkowski and Schweitzer, were effectively overruled by the Geldwin case, which now holds that asbestos claims are dischargeable in bankruptcy. The Third Circuit has joined all the other circuits, at least as I understand it.
But the Schweitzer case itself did not then arise under the Rail Act?
It did not arise under the Rail Act. There had been a claim there that Conrail was a successor, and Judge Ditter, there sitting as the bankruptcy court, held that Conrail was not liable for those claims.
What do you understand the Third Circuit to have held regarding the due process issue?
I think Judge Sloviter, in her opinion, was careful to point out that she was not deciding it. She cited Mullane against Central Hanover Bank a couple of times for the proper.
That had to be addressed.
That's correct. And there's an issue, I think.
So what I'm trying to get at is while that Genrin says exposure is the relevant time, nevertheless, there are these due process considerations, and the Third Circuit says we're not the court to address that, but here are some of the factors that you would take into account. And when I read that, I thought, well, if on remand the district court found that a particular employee of a former railroad who became an employee of Conrail after 1976 didn't know of his condition, didn't know of the nature of the claim, didn't know of the statute of limitations, then what happens? Is it a claim against Conrail? Is that what the Third Circuit was saying?
I don't think the Third Circuit addressed that question.
Yeah,
the court
but left it open, didn't it?
Right. The court was careful to say that we are not that we are not in the business of deciding that right now, much as Judge Wisdom in the Penn Central case said there's some complicated allocation questions which need to be addressed. We're not going to decide those as the special court.
Right, but while you say there's no case against Conrail, the circuits have sort of left it open, haven't they, so far?
Well, the Third Circuit left open a question as to whether there could, whether consistent with the due process clause, a claim against, we'll put it in this context, one of the railroads in reorganization could have been discharged by its plan of reorganization. Presumably, if that claim came up and someone said it was not,
right,
then there would be a question that the bankruptcy court would have to address again in the first instance.
And then we have the Sixth Circuit describing the nature of the Erie Lackawanna liquidation, such that the type of claim in this case could not have been discharged in bankruptcy.
Right, which then brings me back to my elephant in the room point with which I began.
Yeah.
I think my time is up. Let me just say that what we're asking here is that this court hold that the Rail Act conveyance documents and the related conveyance documents along with the conveyance order require that where exposure only occurred pre-April 1st of 1976, there's no Conrail liability. Where exposure spanned conveyance, there would be a question of allocation that would have to be addressed in the underlying trial courts. And I had reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Well, they're gone. We'll give you a minute for rebuttal. Mr. Rhodes.
May it please the court, I'm David Rhodes here for the appellee. I'd like to start by pointing out that it should be considered at this point that the textual argument is conceded. There really has not been any effective response to the painstaking analysis of the district court that says that the terms free and clear of liens and encumbrances does not, by the terms, include FELA claims. That means that what we're looking at is whether, in the face of the clear language not covering it, whether there's a policy reason or some text of some other statute that nevertheless commands that Conrail be let out of potential successor liability. I think in assessing this, it's important to know what is this successor liability that we're talking about, because I heard opposing counsel today say that the question is whether Conrail, which did nothing, ought to somehow become the successor. And it's our position that if Conrail did nothing, we wouldn't be here today. Now, we're not asking that this court address whether Conrail is a successor. That's not before this court. It was not before the district court. The only question is interpretation of the conveyance order. That's the only thing that there was jurisdiction in the district court to determine. But in looking at whether it's possible, notwithstanding that conveyance order, for Conrail to have become a successor, it's important to keep in mind that we're talking about employer successor liability, not landowner successor liability. Now, we're not trying to predicate liability on the mere status of being the owner of the conveyed assets. So it was pointed out by counsel that there was no conveyance of liabilities. Of course, we're not claiming that Conrail's automatically liable because Erie Lackawanna's liabilities followed its assets and were conveyed to Conrail. That's not the theory of this case. We're saying Conrail, which availed itself of the opportunity to hire skilled, experienced employees, became a successor under applicable doctrines that determine when there should be continuity of an employee's ability to look to his employer to remedy certain wrongs. Now, it's not the case that Conrail has never been found a successor for purposes of something similar, because in the Howard case cited in our brief, Conrail was found to have successor liability for a discrimination claim by an employee predicated on discriminatory acts of the predecessor railroad. This context is not that different. When Conrail took over the assets, it didn't have to hire everybody. There was no mandate by Congress that it hired all the employees, but it decided that it was in its interest to employ the skilled employees who knew how to run those railroads. And if it hired an employee with several times broken legs, or if it hired an employee who had been exposed to asbestos for many years and took on the risk that one of those people might assert a claim based on some of those past acts, that was a risk that Conrail could have evaluated. These were not unknown potential claims at the time, and the statute and the conveyance order did not take those risks away from Conrail. Clearly, by their text, they did not. So what we have left... Sorry.
Did you say the asbestos was a risk known at the time?
Yes. Asbestos was coming to be known, and the FELA claims were certainly potentially there because there had been FELA claims for the better part of a century. The point is that the special court has said that unlike CERCLA, which could not have been anticipated, that FELA claims were claims that could be anticipated and adjusted by the courts in figuring out the value of the assets, and presumably then figured out by Conrail in deciding whether it wanted to employ the employers and thereby become a successor employer. There are important...
What about the fact that as to pending FELA claims, Congress provided that those could go forward, that Conrail would be the party responsible for administration, but that it could be reimbursed 100% for any claims that were paid.
Right. Well, what we have there is just silence about what happens with FELA claims that were not pending. But that does not... I don't think we can take that silence and say, therefore, Conrail must be liable. And I don't think Conrail can take the silence and say, therefore, Conrail cannot be liable, because Congress simply didn't address it. They passed a law that said that assets were to be taken free and clear of liens and encumbrances, but they didn't pass any law saying that Conrail could operate free and clear of claims predicated on the conduct of its predecessors. It's significant that the successor liability is not an automatic thing that happens when the conveyance order is signed. It's based on post-conveyance order conduct that voluntarily was undertaken by Conrail. The thrust of the argument that Conrail is making in the face of what we believe is plain text and no real policy is that Section 77 of an entirely different act should be considered to be governing this conveyance. In effect, they say, and I believe they say it expressly in their reply brief, that the special court, in entering the conveyance order, exercised the power of a Section 77 reorganization court under the Bankruptcy Act to convey the asset free and clear of claims. The sole authority for that contention is that courts have described the Rail Act as supplementing the other bankruptcy provisions, including Section 77. That's a very major weight for the word supplementing to be carrying, that because an act that explicitly says what the conveyance order should provide supplements another act that has a different type of conveyance, which is involved in an actual reorganization that has broader protection for the asset purchaser, that automatically those broader protections are part and parcel of the conveyance order under this narrower act. It's a canon of interpretation that I think has a lot of application here, that the specific controls the general. But it's more than just that, because here's specific language that actually applies and governs, and Conrail is seeking to supplant it with general language that's in a statutory scheme supplemented by this specific language, but that by its terms does not apply to this conveyance. And I don't think this court can do that. And I think that it was correct for the lower court not to do that. I'd like to turn to the standard of review. It may be true that Judge Urbino does not yet have a large cache of expertise in this area. I think that as as the years go by, he'll gain that expertise by accretion. But what is true is that his court, and in particular him sitting as the judge of that court, has been charged by Congress with a pretty broad authority that a district court usually does not have, that of all the courts in the entire country, only Judge Urbino is charged by Congress with a discretionary power to oversee conveyance orders and to interpret, alter, amend, modify, or implement those orders. Now, if he were altering one of these orders, amending it, he would be reviewing for abuse of discretion. We submit that when he interprets the order, what should be done is also an abuse of discretion review. I would also point out that it's not the only decision that has interpreted that language in that manner. The textual argument has previously in the Penn Central case been rejected, and it's been said that free and clear is limited to property interests. And then the policy argument was rejected in the Redding case. I'd like to turn to the argument about that. Judge Rogers, you asked, does that undermine the force of the analysis? And the response counsel gave was that the force of the analysis is limited by the court's limited jurisdiction. Your Honor, I believe that response doesn't wash. The analysis had to do with the logic of the situation. The court pointed out that Congress simply didn't think at the time that the aggregate of FELA claims would sink Conrail, unlike the aggregate of, for example, pension benefits. The employee benefits issue was a major sticking point because they had grown to the point where it was material to Conrail's ability to function. The court said that at the time the FELA wasn't such a big deal, and that there's no indication that Congress thought that it was crucial, and so there's a reason that they explicitly said that there wouldn't be successor liability for some of these benefit plans or limited successor liability. In the Rail Act, there was a provision that addressed liability for employee benefits. There is no such provision that addressed liability for FELA claims.
And what section is that? Sorry.
I'm sorry. I'll have to search for that, Your Honor. But it's cited in the Redding case.
About fraud and child support and that type of thing.
Well, I think they're thinking mostly about ERISA.
In response to Judge Ginsburg's question, this section that you're relying on.
The section, I don't know the number of the section off the top of my head, but it's cited in the Redding case. The court was contrasting the protection that was given for employee benefit claims, and there was a cutoff of successor liability for those. And it said there's a reason that they would have treated FELA claims differently by not protecting from them because they weren't considered to be that material. The force of that argument that says that the free and clear policy just didn't take account of FELA claims is not limited by the jurisdiction of the court. It either rises or falls on its own logic. In any event, Your Honor, the special court has more than once found that the policy of free and clear does not require this, and it has more than once found that the language of liens and encumbrances does not cover this, and we think that that should give at least some deference, and on the precedent it's not clear how much deference, but the fact that Congress assigned all such questions to this particular court we believe makes it function more like an agency than like a typical lower federal court. Your Honor, there's been a suggestion that there's some significance to the fact that there are other potential defendants out there. We think that does not have any proper place in this court's analysis. This decision is likely to govern dozens of other cases. The particular circumstances may be different case by case. The ability to collect from other defendants may be limited. The fact that 83 are named does not mean that the plaintiff has had his full compensation from them. He worked for the Erie Lackawanna Railroad Company for decades, and most, if not all, of his exposure happened while he was working for that company.
What do you make of the Third Circuit's due process argument?
Well, Your Honor, the Third Circuit, I believe, held that it was mistaken when it previously said that claims under Section 77 could never include after-occurring asbestos where there had been prior exposure, but that it stopped short of holding that it always included those because it was not clear that somebody who had exposure only had sufficient notice and an opportunity to be heard bringing his claim. And so it left that question open. I think that that question is a vexing question that would be very difficult to resolve generally. It may require a case-by-case analysis. We think that ultimately it doesn't matter to the resolution of the present case because that section 77 that has the either broader or less broad interpretation of claims does not govern the conveyance order in this case. And we don't think that there's any proper alchemy that can turn a conveyance order under the Rail Act into a conveyance order under Section 77. We think that that's fundamental to the determination of this case and fatal to the Conrail's position in it. I'd like to point out one other thing that was said, that there'd never been a Court of Appeals argument or decision involving the Rail Act. The Conrail against the ICC decision by this court did not explicitly come under the Rail Act, but the court actually mentioned the Rail Act in saying that the free and clear provision of the Rail Act didn't go so far as to absolve Conrail from responsibility for regulatory burdens based on regulations imposed on the predecessor railroads. So there is at least some limitation recognized by this court on the supposedly wide-ranging free and clear provision. I see, Your Honor, that I have 3 seconds left, so I would stop with that.
Questions for Mr. Rhodes? No. Thank you, Mr. Rhodes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sheikman, I'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two quick points. The question of whether Conrail is an employer or a landowner doesn't really matter. The issue before the court is whether if Conrail did nothing other than continue rail operations after April 1st, 1976, by that conduct alone.
And hire these employees.
Yeah, although if you were to look at the full, I didn't realize that question was going to come up, but if you look at the full context of the Rail Act, the hiring was required, was not voluntary, as my opponent suggests.
Let me be very clear about that. Congress required Conrail to hire the employees of the bankrupt railroads?
That's correct. One other point, and then I'll sit down, which is the Howard case involved a Title VII discrimination case. The Northern District of Ohio there, probably in violation of the special court's jurisdiction, held that Conrail was not liable for pre-conveyance damages, but that Conrail was the only party which was available to provide injunctive relief prospectively, and the court limited its holding to that effect. And finally, in my 2 seconds remaining, I'll say this. There is no decision of a court of appeals other than this court's decision in Jersey City ever reviewing a decision of the special court. That was the first.
Thank you, Mr. Chief.
Thank you, Your Honor.